welcome to the Book Report.
I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Do you ever wonder about the New York Times bestseller list? It is so crucial to the publishing world. So what's the story behind it? The first Times bestseller list was published in 1931 for New York City only. By the early 1940s, 14 city lists were included. A national list was created on April 9, 1942. But aha, here's what you're waiting for. The exact methodology of ranking by bookseller sales figures remains a trade secret. So if you take just a cursory glance at the list, it might seem that the same authors, quite popular fellows, are always there, like James Patterson and John Grisham. But this week, let's go a bit deeper and salute the ladies of the list. Some names you'll know, some will be welcome discoveries. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. First off from the book report, Jennifer McMahon returns with The Winter People, a thriller about ghostly secrets, dark choices, and the unbreakable bond between mothers and daughters. West Hall, Vermont has always been a town of strange disappearances and old legends. The most mysterious is that of Sarah Harrison Shea, who, in 1908, was found dead in the field behind her house just months after the tragic death of her daughter Gertie. Now 19-year-old Ruthie lives in Sarah's farmhouse with her mother Alice and her younger sister. Alice has always insisted they live off the grid, a decision that proves perilous when Ruthie wakes up one morning to find Alice has vanished without a trace. Searching for clues, she finds a copy of Sarah Harrison Shea's diary hidden beneath the floorboards of her mother's bedroom. As Ruthie delves deeper into the mystery of Sarah's fate, she discovers she's not the only person looking for someone they've lost. Cassandra Campbell and Kathy Mazur narrate.
"Is it really possible," I asked, "to bring someone back like that?" We were down by the river, picking fiddleheads, filling Auntie's basket with the curled fern tops as we did each spring. Then we'd bring them home and make a creamy soup stuffed full of wild greens and herbs that Auntie had gathered along the way. We were also there to check the traps. Auntie had caught a beaver just 2 days before and was hoping for another. Beaver pelts were a rarity and brought a high price. They were once nearly as common as squirrels, Auntie said, but trappers had taken all except a handful. Buckshot was with us, nosing the ground, ears attentive to every little sound. I never knew if he was all wolf or only part. Auntie had found him as a pup, when he'd fallen into one of her pit traps after being all shot up by someone. She'd carried him home, pulled the buckshot pellets out of him, stitched him up, and nursed him back to health. He'd been by her side ever since.
"He was lucky you found him,"
I said after hearing the story.
"Luck had nothing to do with it," Auntie told me. "He and I were meant for one another."
I never saw such devotion in a dog, or any animal for that matter. His wounds had healed, but the buckshot left him blind in his right eye, which was milky white.
"His ghost eye," Auntie called it. "He came so close to death, he's got one eye back there still," she explained.
I loved Buckshot, but I hated that milky white moon that seemed to see everything and nothing all at once. Auntie was not related to me by blood, but she cared for me, raised me after my own mother died giving birth to me. I had no memory of my mother. The only proofs of her existence were my parents' wedding photograph, the quilt she'd sewn that I slept under every night, and the stories my older brother and sister told. My brother claimed I had my mother's laugh. My sister said that my mother had been the best dancer in the county, that she was the envy of all the other girls. Auntie's people came from up north, in Quebec. Her father had been a trapper, her mother an Indian woman. Auntie carried a hunting knife and wore a long deerskin coat decorated with bright beads and porcupine quills. She spoke French and sang songs in a language I never did recognize.
She wore a ring carved from yellowed bone on her right pointer finger.
"What does it say?"
I asked once, touching the strange letters and symbols on its surface.
"That life is a circle," she answered.
People in town were frightened of Auntie, but their fear did not keep them away from her door. They followed the well-worn path to her cabin in the woods out behind the Devil's Hand, carrying coins, honey, whiskey, whatever they had to trade for her remedies. Auntie had drops for colic, tea for fever, even a little blue bottle that she swore contained a potion so powerful that with one drop the object of your heart's desire would be yours. I knew better than to doubt her. There were other things I knew about Auntie, too. I'd seen her sneak out of Papa's bedroom in the early morning, heard the sounds that came from behind his locked door when she visited him there. I also knew better than to cross her. She had a fiery temper and little patience with people who did not see things her way. If people refused to pay her for her services, she'd call on them, sprinkle their homes with black powder pulled from one of her leather pouches, and speak a strange incantation. Terrible things would befall those families from then on. Sicknesses, fires, crop losses, even death.
That was The Winter People by Jennifer McMahon. New from Book Report favorite Alice Hoffman, The Museum of Extraordinary Things is a love story set in New York and spotlighting two vastly different souls during the volatile first decades of the 20th century. Coralie is the daughter of the impresario behind the Museum of Extraordinary Things, a Coney Island boardwalk freak show. An exceptional swimmer, Coralie appears as the mermaid in her father's museum, alongside performers like the Wolfman and the Butterfly Girl. One evening, away from the museum, Coralie discovers a young man photographing moonlit trees in the woods off the Hudson River. The dashing photographer is Eddie Cohen, a Russian immigrant who's run away from his father's Lower East Side Orthodox community and his job as an apprentice tailor. When Eddie photographs the devastation on the streets following the infamous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, he becomes embroiled in a mystery concerning a young woman's disappearance. New York itself becomes a riveting character as Hoffman weaves her magic, romance, and masterful storytelling. An ensemble cast narrates.
There before me were the many treasures my father had collected over the years. The hand with eight fingers, the human skull with horns, the preserved remains of a scarlet-colored, long-legged bird called a spoonbill, rocks veined with luminous markings that glowed yellow in the dark, as if stars themselves had been trapped inside stone. I was fascinated by all that was strange, the jaw of an ancient elephant called a mastodon, and the shoes of a giant found in the mountains of Switzerland. Though these exhibits made my skin prickle with fear, I felt at home among such things. Yet, I knew that a life spent inside a museum is not a life like any other. Sometimes I had dreams in which the jars broke, and the floor was awash with a murky green mixture of water and salt and formaldehyde. When I woke from such nightmares, the hem of my nightgown would be soaking wet. It made me wonder how far the waking world was from the world of dreams. My mother died of influenza when I was only an infant, and although I never knew her, whenever I dreamed of terrible, monstrous creatures and awoke shivering and crying in my bed, I wished I had a mother who loved me. I always hoped my father would sing me to sleep and treat me as if I were a treasure, as valued as the museum exhibits he often paid huge sums to buy. But he was too busy and preoccupied, and I understood his life's work was what mattered most. I was a dutiful daughter, at least until I reached a certain age. I was not allowed to play with other children who would not have understood where I lived or how I'd been raised. Nor could I go upon the streets of Brooklyn on my own, where there were men who were waiting to molest innocent girls like me. Long ago, what the Indians called Nariok was a deserted land, used in winter for grazing cattle and horses and oxen. The Dutch referred to it as Konijn Eiland, Rabbit Island, and had little interest in its sandy shores. Now, there were those who said Konijn Island had become a vile place, much like Sodom, where people thought only of pleasure. Some communities, like Brighton Beach and Manhattan Beach, where the millionaires built their estates, had their own trains with paid conductors to keep out the riffraff. Trains for the masses left from the Brooklyn Bridge terminal and took little more than half an hour to reach the beachfront communities. The subway was being built to begin running beneath the East River in 1908, so that more and more throngs would be able to leave the brutal heat of Manhattan in the summertime. The island was a place of contradiction, stretching from the wicked areas where men were alternately entertained and cheated in houses of ill repute and saloons, to the iron pavilions and piers, where the great John Philip Sousa had brought his orchestra to play beneath the stars in the year I was born. Coney Island was, above all else, a place of dreams, with amusements like no others, rides that defied the rules of gravity, concerts and games of chance, ballrooms with so many electric lights that glowed as if on fire. It was here that there had once been a hotel in the shape of an elephant which proudly stood 162 feet high until it burned to the ground. Here the world's first roller coaster, the Switchback Railway, gave birth to more and more elaborate and wilder rides. The great parks were the Steeplechase and Luna Park, whose star attraction, the famous Horse King, dove from a high platform into a pool of water. On Surf Avenue was the aptly named Dreamland, which was being built and would soon rise across the street, so that we could see its towers from our garden path. There were hundreds of other attractions along Surf Avenue up to Ocean Parkway, so many entertainments I didn't know how people chose. For me, the most beautiful constructions were the carousels, with their magical, bejeweled, carved animals, many created by Jewish craftsmen from the Ukraine. The El Dorado, which was being installed at the foot of Dreamland Park, was a true amazement, three-tiered and teeming with animals of every sort. My favorites were the tigers, so fierce their green eyes sparked with an inner light, and, of course, the horses with their manes flying out behind them. So real, I imagined that if I were ever allowed onto one, I might ride away and never return.
We've just heard The Museum of Extraordinary Things by Alice Hoffman. Sue Monk Kidd hails from the small town of Sylvester, Georgia, a place that deeply influenced her first novel, The Secret Life of Bees. She graduated from Texas Christian University and later took creative writing courses at Emory and Anderson College. Her book, When the Heart Waits, was published in 1990 and became a touchstone on contemplative spirituality. In 1996, she published The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, describing her journey into feminist theology. Kidd then turned her attention to writing fiction. When her first novel, The Secret Life of Bees, was published in 2002, it spent more than 2.5 years on the New York Times bestseller list. Her second novel, The Mermaid Chair, was also a bestseller. Today we'll be speaking with Sue about her third novel, The Invention of Wings, which has been selected by Oprah as the third selection for her book club 2.0. Welcome, Sue, and I'm so happy to have you with us on the Book Report today.
Well, thank you for having me.
How did you come across the story of Sarah and Angelina Grimke?
Ironically enough, I had to come to New York to find out about the Grimke sisters, even though I was living in South Carolina, in Charleston, where they were born. I came to the Brooklyn Museum to see the Judy Chicago Dinner Party exhibit, and I found their names on the heritage panels. These are women who've made significant contributions to Western history, and there they were.
Oh, and how did you begin researching the sisters? What sources did you use?
When I came home from that museum visit, I began to read everything I could find about them. There are a few biographies, actually, but there's one in particularly by Gerda Lerner, and when I read it, I knew I wanted to write their story in a fictional way. But I had to read a lot, really, for 6 months. I researched nonstop, it seemed like, trying to get a feel of 19th century history in Charleston, urban slavery, American slavery, the Grimke sisters themselves, and just get the whole landscape. So I was traveling to the Library of Congress and various historical societies trying to track all this down. So it was an amazing experience for me.
Well, Hetty, who is also called Handful, and her mother Charlotte, the Grimke's house slaves, they were based on actual people?
Well, in the sketchiest way, they were. Of course, Sarah and Angelina are historical figures who were the first female abolition agents in America and some of our early women's rights pioneers. But Handful, Hetty Handful, was an enslaved girl in the Grimke household who was given to Sarah as a waiting maid. I mean, Sarah grew up in this wealthy slaveholding family in Charleston, and she was given this present of a human present. And all we really know about this girl was that she was taught to read and by Sarah, and they were caught and punished, and then she died very young. So I suppose she is based on a real person, though her life is completely fictionalized.
Now, why the title, The Invention of Wings?
Well, I wanted to portray a sense of flight, the quest for freedom. The novel is really about two women questing for freedom in very different ways. You know, a white privileged woman who has no rights, who's vastly limited because of her gender. And then, of course, Handful, this enslaved woman who is questing for even a more powerful need for freedom. And I wanted to find a title that would carry that. And I stumbled on this wonderful African-American folk tale about people in Africa being able to fly and then losing their wings when they were enslaved and then trying to get them back. So it comes out of that.
The Grimke sisters, as you alluded to before, were ardent speakers against abolition, and they traveled extensively in support of their cause. But gradually, they moved into also supporting women's rights, yet they met with opposition in this blending of causes. How so?
Well, they were the ones who linked women's rights and abolition for the first time. You know, it was interesting to me in my research to discover that it was in fighting for the rights of others that women in this country discovered their own oppression. And Angelina and Sarah felt that if they could just speak in the public sphere about, you know, with their anti-slavery doctrines and oratory, that they could do so much more, but they were limited. Women didn't, at that time, they didn't speak outside the domestic sphere publicly to what they call mixed audiences. And I'm talking gender here, not speaking to men in a public, social, political way. So that was the barrier they were really trying to break.
Hmm. Did the Grimke sisters actually befriend Lucretia Mott?
They knew of her, yes. I took that connection they had in Philadelphia, which was, I don't know the extent of that friendship, but they belonged to the same Quaker meeting, and they definitely knew each other. And Lucretia Mott, I think they visited, and Lucretia Mott was in some ways affected and influenced by Sarah Grimke and her sister's writings and life. But I took it and extrapolated a great deal more into it, grafting on some imagination in that relationship.
Hmm. I was fascinated by the character of Denmark Vesey. Tell us a little about him.
Well, I was fascinated, too. I have to say, he was a very charismatic, free black who lived in Charleston at the time that my novel is set. And he plotted the largest slave insurrection in America. And it failed, but if it hadn't failed, I mean, we would all know that name very readily, I think, because it was quite a plot that he put together. And I wanted to entwine that plot with the lives of my character, Henful, and her mother, Charlotte.
What year was that about his uprising?
It was in the making for years, but in the early 1820s, in 1820, around there.
Hmm. You describe several torture methods that were inflicted on the slaves, the treadmill, the truss, the iron muzzle. So horrible. I mean, how commonplace were these?
Well, it's hard to say how frequently they were used, but they were certainly real, unfortunately. Horrific ways of punishment and controlling the enslaved population at the time. I didn't know about these workhouses until I began researching, and I discovered that they were in urban centers in the South, and these were places where slaves could actually be sent and punished for a fee, which is incredibly disturbing to imagine this. But there were other forms of punishment besides floggings.
Hmm.
I mean, there were all kinds of iron contraptions, birdcage contraptions that could be put over the head or muzzles. And how frequently that was used, these other methods were used, I don't know. But make no mistake, I mean, it was often used, yes.
Right, and even Sarah's mother employed some horrifying torture methods right there on her own property.
Yes, you know, there's no historical evidence of exactly what kind of punishment she used on her slaves, but I do know from biography of Sarah and Angelina that their mother was a difficult woman who often gave common punishments, it said, to her slaves. So I think she was one of those typical belles who was supportive of the slave system and did everything she could to keep that system in place using, I mean, very cruel treatment sometimes.
Hmm. Handful's mother expressed herself through quilting. Can you share a little bit about that story?
Yes. I wanted to put a story quilt into the novel because Handful's mother, Charlotte, was an illiterate woman who really wanted to preserve and express her story. And storytelling is an important part of this novel, that need we have to take the disparate parts of our lives and stitch them together in a whole and have our lives witnessed, so to speak, or to create meaning out of our story. I think this was an instinct and a need that my character had. And so she takes her needle and thread and she creates a visual memoir by telling the story of her life in quilt squares.
Any final thoughts about your book?
You know, the themes of race and gender are very large in this novel, but it's also, I think, a story about searching for our selfhood and our voice and then the courage to express it in the world.
Right. I mean, one of my favorite passages in your book was spoken by Sarah, and she said, "I couldn't have explained then how the oak tree lives inside the acorn, or how I suddenly realized that in some enigmatic way, something lived inside of me, the woman I would become."
Yes, when we all have that, don't we?
Yes.
That part of ourselves that wants to grow and become. And the difficulty sometimes is finding a way to let that happen. And it usually comes down to a lot of courage. And it did for Sarah. She had to find her way with that against enormous odds. But she does invent her wings just as Handful does.
Absolutely. Sue, thank you so much for joining us today. I loved your book, and I would encourage everyone to go pick it up. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
All righty. Bye now. And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Invention of Wings, performed by the author, Jenna Lamia and Adepero Aduye.
The master and missus, they did all the proper naming, but a mama would look on her baby laid in its basket and a name would come to her. Something about what her baby looked like, what day of the week it was, what the weather was doing, or just how the world seemed on that day. My mama's basket name was Summer, but her proper name was Charlotte. She had a brother whose basket name was Hard Time. People think I make that up, but it's true as it can be. If you got a basket name, you at least had something from your mama. Master Grimke named me Hetty. But mama looked at me on the day I came into the world, how I was born too soon, and she called me Handful. That day, while I helped our aunt's sister in the yard, mama was in the house working on a gold sateen dress for Mrs. with a bustle on the back, what's called a watteau gown. She was the best seamstress in Charleston and worked her fingers stiff with the needle. You never saw such finery as my mama could whip up, and she didn't use a stamping pattern. She hated a book pattern. She picked out the silks and velvets her own self at the market and made everything the Grimkes had. Window curtains, quilted petticoats, looped panniers, buckskin pants, and these done-up jockey outfits for race week. I can tell you this much. White people lived for race week. They had one picnic, promenade, and fancy going on after another. Mrs. King's party was always on Tuesday, the jockey club dinner on Wednesday. The big fuss came Saturday with the St. Cecilia ball when they strutted out in their best dresses. Aunt's sister said Charleston had a case of the granges. Up till I was 8 or so, I thought the granges was a shitting sickness. Mrs. was a short, thick waist woman with what looked like little balls of dough under her eyes. She refused to hire out Mama to the other ladies. They begged her, and Mama begged her too, because she would have kept a portion of those wages for herself. But Mrs. said, I can't have you make anything for them better than you make for us. In the evenings, Mama tore strips for her quilts, while I held the tallow candle with one hand and stacked the strips in piles with the other, always by color, neat as a pin. She liked her colors bright. Putting shades together nobody would think. Purple and orange, pink and red. The shape she loved was a triangle. Always black. Mama put black triangles on about every quilt she sewed. We had a wooden patch box for keeping our scraps, a pouch for our needles and threads, and a true brass thimble. Mama said the thimble would be mine one day. But she wasn't using it, I wore it on my fingertip like a jewel. We filled our quilts up with raw cotton and wool thrums. The best filling was feathers, still is, and Mama and I never passed one on the ground without picking it up. Some days, Mama would come in with a pocket full of goose feathers she'd plucked from mattress holes in the house. When we got desperate to fill a quilt, we'd strip the long moss from the oak in the work yard and sew it between the lining and the quilt top, chiggers and all. That was the thing Mama and I loved. Our time with the quilts. No matter what Aunt's sister had me doing in the yard, I always watched the upstairs window where Mama did her stitching. We had a signal. When I turned the pail upside down by the kitchen house, that meant everything was clear. Mama would open the window and throw down a taffy she stole from Mrs. Room. Sometimes here came a bundle of cloth scraps. Real nice calicoes, gingham, muslin, some import linen. One time, that true brass thimble. Her favorite thing to take was scarlet red thread. She would wind it up in her pocket and walk right out the house with it. The yard was over busy that day, so I didn't have hope for a taffy falling from the clear blue. Mariah, the laundry slave, had burned her hand on charcoal from the iron and was laid up. Aunt sister was on a tear about the backed up wash. Tomfrey had the men fixing to butcher a hog that was running and screeching at the top of its lungs. Everyone was out there. From old Snow, the carriage driver, all the way down to the stable mucker, Prince. Tomfrey wanted to get the killing over quick because Mrs. hated yard noise.
That was The Invention of Wings by Sue Monk Kidd. After I'm Gone by Laura Lippman begins in 1959 as Felix Brewer meets 19-year-old Bernadette Bambi Gottschalk at a Valentine's Day dance.
he charms her with wild promises, some of which he actually keeps. Thanks to his lucrative, if not entirely legal, businesses, she and their three little girls live in luxury. But on the 4th of July in 1976, Bambi's comfortable world implodes when Felix, facing prison, vanishes. Though Bambi has no idea where her husband or his money might be, she suspects one woman does, his young mistress, Julie. When Julie disappears 10 years to the day after Felix's disappearance, everyone assumes she's left to join her old lover, until her remains are discovered in a secluded park. Now, some 26 years later, Roberto Sandy Sanchez, a retired Baltimore detective working cold cases, begins to investigate her murder. What he discovers is a tangled web of bitterness, jealousy, resentment, greed, and a longing stretching over five decades. Linda Eamon narrates.
Bambi wouldn't have liked that Julie was driving him. If she were ever going to break some crockery, that might be the moment. But Julie was the best person for the job. Her sister actually had horses, or access to them, so it was plausible for the two of them to be hauling a trailer north. Besides, Julie was going to have it hard once he was gone. Bambi had the girls, friends, family. Julie didn't have anyone except her sister, an odd duck, and that was being kind. The puss on that one when she took the wheel. This better be forever, she muttered. You're getting yours, he reminded her. Everybody was getting theirs, one way or another. Forever. That was the word that Julie had repeated when he explained things to her last week. It wasn't quite a question, more like a concept she had never heard before. They had been sitting in the little coffee shop, his one legitimate business. The weekly receipts wouldn't have kept his girls in hair ribbons, and his girls actually wore hair ribbons. Bambi dressed them like Towson preppies, all pink and green, taught them how to blow-dry their unruly hair into ponytails. Well, not the baby, but the baby was a dead ringer for Bambi. Hair as sleek and dark as a seal's, blue eyes, impossible eyelashes. Linda was the organized one. Rachel was the smart one. And while they were both pretty, Michelle was going to be the beautiful one. They were going to make their mark on the world, each in her own way. And he was going to miss all of it. All of it. Forever, Julie repeated, drawing out the syllables, tracing the watery ring left by her Coke. She hardly drank, this one, although she pretended to at night, sipping scotch to keep him company. Looks that way, unless something unexpected happens. Another long silence. Julie was one of those odd women who was prettier when she didn't smile. Stone-faced, she was a sultry enigma. When she grinned, she still looked like the hick teenager that Tubby scouted in the Rexall 4 years ago. 7.5%, she said at last. What? The country is 200 years old this year. They're asking you to give 7.5% of the country's entire history. That's a lot. And you know I don't give points easily. A quick smile at that. She used to have bad teeth before he fixed them, another reason that she didn't smile much. Julie didn't actually have a great sense of humor, anyway. She was a little literal-minded for that. A dollars-and-cents girl. Very practical. A practical mistress was a good thing. She had never entertained the thought that he would marry her, for example, although there was that tiny little weirdness last year. She understood that Bambi was the love of his life. It was Julie, after she started some community college class, who told him F. Scott Fitzgerald said, "The test of a first-class mind was holding two conflicting ideas in your head without going nuts." Felix was an old hand at that. He loved Bambi. He needed other women. Julie had been with him for a year when Michelle was born, but she didn't act like it was a betrayal, the way some girlfriends might have. Of course he still slept with his wife. She was his wife and very attractive, and he was crazy in love with her. Being with Julie wasn't an expression of dissatisfaction with Bambi. It's just that life was better when you ordered a la carte. There had been girls other than Julie, too. A one-nighter here or there. Because he could. Because he needed to. If only Bambi would let go of that piece of her she kept locked away. If only she weren't so damn self-sufficient.
That was a sampling of After I'm Gone by Laura Lippman. Kelly Corrigan's memoir, Glitter and Glue, examines the bond, sometimes nourishing, sometimes exasperating, occasionally divine, between mothers and daughters. When Kelly was in high school, her mother neatly summarized the family dynamic as, "Your father's the glitter, but I'm the glue." This meant nothing to Kelly at the time. After college, Kelly armed herself with a backpack and took off for Australia to discover the world and herself. But it didn't quite turn out the way she pictured it. In a matter of months, her savings shot. She had a choice: go home or get a job. That's how Kelly met John Tanner, a newly widowed father of two, looking for a live-in nanny. They chatted for an hour, discussed timing and pay, and a week later, Kelly moved in. And there, in that house in Sydney, 10,000 miles from the house where Kelly was raised, her mother's voice was suddenly everywhere, nudging and advising, cautioning and directing, escorting her through a terrain as foreign as any she'd ever trekked. Every day she spent with the Tanner kids was a day spent reconsidering her relationship with her mom, turning it over in her hands like a shell. This is a book about the difference between travel and life experience, stepping out and stepping up. But mostly the book, performed by the author, is about who you admire and why, and how that can change as the years pass by.
When I was growing up, my mom was guided by the strong belief that to befriend me was to deny me the one thing a kid really needed to survive childhood, a mother. Consequently, we were never one of those mommy and me pairs who sat close or giggled. She didn't wink at me or gush about how pretty I looked or rub my back to help me fall asleep. She was not a big fan of deep conversation, and she still doesn't go for a lot of physical contact. She looked at motherhood less as a joy to be relished than as a job to be done, serious work with serious repercussions. And I left childhood assuming our way of being with each other, adversarial but functional, was as it would be. If my mother thought of me as someone to guide, my father thought of me as someone to cheer. I was his girl, as in, "That's my girl. Have you met my girl?" He liked to hold hands and high five and was almost impossible to frustrate or disappoint. His signature, "You bet, why not?" energy was all I needed for several decades. But then my life became more consequential, and I woke up needing things he could not supply. A certain understanding, call it a seasoning, that only my mother seemed to have. Her areas of expertise, which had often appeared piddling or immaterial, became disturbingly relevant. And that's saying nothing about the second-guessing and anxieties I could take to her, worries that would only ever bounce off my dad's optimism. As was the case on the day I was told I needed surgery. I remember leaving the doctor thinking three things. I can't have more kids. It's for my own good. I need my mom. On the way to the parking lot, I dialed home, or I should say the place that was home when I was a child. My dad ran to pick up the phone on the first ring. I know because I've seen him do it 100 times. He loves connecting. He's dying to catch up. He can't wait to hear your voice, anyone's voice. "Lovey," he sang out, as if it had been years, not days, since we talked. "How's my girl?" "I'm okay. Is Mom there?" I wasn't crying, but I wanted to. "What?" he said in mock hysteria. "You don't want to talk to Greeny, the green man?" My dad's brothers have been calling him Greeny since college. I'd always thought it referred to the Irish in him, but it turns out it's more about a bad hangover. "You're breaking my heart, Lovey." "Sorry, I just need Mom. She's at the bridge table, probably making her opponents weep right this minute." I asked him to have her call me when she got back and told him I couldn't talk right now. That was A-OK with him because everything is A-OK with him. Love you, mean it. He signed off as usual. Love you, mean it. Before I got in my car, I called my mom's cell and left a message explaining that Dr. Rawson would be taking out my ovaries a week from Thursday. I tried to sound cool and relaxed about it. I said I was being spayed, ha-ha. I hoped she would hear past my witty BS. 2 years before, a lump I found in my breast turned out to be a 7-centimeter tumor. So I did what people with tumors do: chemotherapy, radiation, surgery. I also started taking a tiny pill every day to suppress ovarian function, since my cancer used estrogen to multiply. After 90 days, my periods kept coming. I bragged to the doc that I was born to breed. Turned out there was something on my ovary, a cyst most likely, but it did not wax and wane the way cysts should. It sat there, stubborn, ominous. The time had come. "You have kids?" the doctor asked. "Yeah, 2 girls, 3 and 5. We do this now, maybe we avoid something worse later." Crossing the Bay Bridge, San Francisco disappearing behind me, I did not call my husband. Edward was a reasonable man who took zinc at the first sign of a cold, stretched thoroughly before and after exercise, and when lifting heavy objects, used his legs, not his back. He was, in all situations, an advocate for avoiding something worse. I did not call either of my older brothers, I do not have a sister, and I was not quite ready to involve a girlfriend. So I called my mom's cell again, and this time she answered. She said she just hung up with the idiot at the airlines who wouldn't accept her frequent flyer miles, which were barely expired. And I said, God help the customer service guy who took that call. But what I thought was, she's coming.
That was Glitter and Glue by Kelly Corrigan. In Moving Target, Book 9 of the Allie Reynolds series, Judith Ann Jantz, better known as J.A. Jantz, spans continents to solve a cold case murder. Lance Tucker, an incarcerated juvenile offender and talented hacker, is set on fire and severely burned while hanging Christmas decorations in a lockup rec room. Bea Simpson, Allie Reynolds' fiancé, and the man who helped put Lance in jail, feels obliged to get to the bottom of what happened. With Allie off in England helping her friend Leland Brooks, Bea turns to someone else to help out. Allie's good friend and taser-carrying nun, Sister Anselm. Meanwhile, in England, Allie begins to investigate the decades-old murder of Leland's father, a crime in which Leland himself was once a suspect. With unsolved murders on both sides of the Atlantic, Allie, Bea, and Sister Anselm are united by their search for answers and the dangers they face as a result. Karen Ziemba narrates.
Lance Tucker had always hated ladders, but between climbing up and down a ladder in the recreation hall and sitting through another one of Mrs. Stone's endless GED classes, there was no contest. Climbing the rickety ladder to decorate the 9-foot Christmas tree was definitely the lesser of two evils. Lance was 5 months into a 6-month sentence at the San Leandro County Juvenile Justice Center facility in the hill country some 50 miles northwest of Austin. All his life he had hated having a December birthday, hated having whatever he was getting for his birthday and Christmas lumped into a single gift that never measured up to what other kids got. This year, though, his turning 18 on December 18th meant that Lance would be out of jail in time for Christmas, out and able to go home. The problem with that, of course, was that he might not have a home to go to. The last time he'd seen his mother, on visiting day 2 weeks ago, she had told him that she was probably going to lose the house. She'd finally admitted to him that she'd had to take out a second mortgage in order to pay the king's ransom he owed in court-ordered restitution. Now that her hours had been cut back at work, she wasn't able to keep up the payments on both mortgages, which meant that most likely the house would go into foreclosure. That was all his fault, too. Ears reddening with shame, Lance climbed down the ladder, moved it a few inches toward the next undecorated section of branches, picked up another tray of decorations and clambered back up. "Don't think about it," he told himself firmly. What was it the counselor kept saying? Don't waste your time worrying about things you can't change. This definitely fell into the category of stuff that couldn't be changed. What's done was done. He heard a burst of laughter from the classroom. It was just off the dining room. The kids were probably giving Mrs. Stone hell again. He felt sorry for her. She seemed a nice enough person, and he knew she was genuinely trying to help them. But what she was offering, coursework leading up to earning a GED, wasn't at all what Lance wanted. It had never been part of what he had envisioned as his own future. A year ago, just last May, his future had been promising. As a high school junior honor student at San Leandro High, Lance had been enrolled in 3 advanced placement classes and had done well on his SATs, coming in with a respectable 2290. With the help of his beloved math teacher, Mr. Jackson, Lance had been preparing to lead his computer science club team to their 3rd consecutive championship for that year's Longhorn Computer Science Competition. Now his life had changed, and not for the better. Mr. Jackson was dead. Lance's mother had told him that San Leandro High had won the Longhorn Trophy after all, but without Lance's help, because someone else was the team captain now. As for doing his senior year in the top 10% of his class and getting to wear whatever he wanted to school, that had changed too. Now Lance found himself locked up 24 hours a day and with nothing to wear but orange jumpsuits. The state of Texas offered college scholarships to kids in the top 10% of their respective classes, but he wouldn't be able to take advantage of that either. Lance was now officially considered to be a high school dropout with an institution-earned GED as his best possible educational outcome. No matter what his SAT score said, trying to get into Texas A&M or any college with only a lowly GED to his credit wasn't going to work. The problem was that the GED class was the only one offered inside the facility. Some of the other kids were able to take online classes, but since Lance's sentence stipulated no computer or internet access, those classes weren't available to him. His court-mandated restrictions made the GED the only route possible. It was also boring as hell.
That was Moving Target by J.A. Jantz.
Since its publication in 1925, The Great Gatsby has become one of the world's best-loved books. Careless People by Sarah Churchwell tells the true story behind Fitzgerald's masterpiece, exploring the relation of Fitzgerald's classic to the chaotic world in which he lived. Fitzgerald set his novel in 1922, and Careless People carefully reconstructs the crucial months during which Scott and Zelda returned to New York in that autumn. The parties, the drunken weekends at Great Neck, Long Island, the drives back into the city to the jazz clubs and speakeasies, the casual intersection of high society and organized crime, and the growth of celebrity culture, of which the Fitzgeralds themselves were the epitome. And for the first time, it returns to the story of Gatsby, the high-profile murder that provided a crucial inspiration for Fitzgerald's tale. Churchwell traces the genesis of a masterpiece, discovering where fiction comes from and how it takes shape in the mind of a genius. Kate Redding performs this fascinating blend of biography and history.
Most of my friends drank too much. The more they were in tune to the times, the more they drank. Fitzgerald published a short autobiography in The New Yorker, offering a summary of each year of his drinking life, beginning when he was 17 and bringing his career up to date. 1929. A feeling that all liquor has been drunk, and all it can do for one has been experienced, and yet... Garçon, un Chablis mouton, 1902, et pour commencer... Une petite carafe de vin rose, c'est ça. Merci. The entry for 1922 reads, Collie Coleman's Creme de Cacao Cocktails in St. Paul, my own first and last manufacture of gin. This brief foray into bathtub gin was most likely also in St. Paul, and almost certainly in a spirit of fun. Making gin didn't require a bathtub. The name originated from the size of the jar used, which people tended to fill from the faucet in the bath. Part of Gatsby's business, we learn, was selling grain alcohol over the counter from drugstores, which most Americans used to make their gin. Burton Rasko explained the system in his 1947 autobiography. Given the well-publicized risks of buying from bootleggers, the safest way was to make synthetic gin oneself. A great many drugstore proprietors dispensed bonded whiskey on prescription and grain alcohol without it. It was easy to find a doctor who would write such a prescription, but it cost a fortune, as one had to bribe the doctor in addition to paying a hefty premium for real whiskey. Most druggists, however, seemed to have an unlimited supply of grain alcohol in gallon cans, tested and guaranteed to be pure, and far more affordable. Nearly everybody who drank used synthetic gin until bootlegging became well-organized in around 1926, said Rasko, helpfully sharing his recipe. Preserved among Fitzgerald's papers is his handwritten recipe for bathtub gin, which was almost the same as Rasko's. If 1922 was indeed Fitzgerald's first and last manufacture of gin, then this undated recipe may come from the year in which Gatsby is set. The Fitzgeralds were also acquainted with a bootlegger named Max Gerlach. Zelda would tell one of Fitzgerald's earliest biographers that J. Gatsby was based on a neighbor named Von Gerlach or something, who was said to be General Pershing's nephew and was in trouble over bootlegging. When Gerlach became Gatsby, he lost his American uncle and acquired a more villainous German one. One time he killed a man who had found out that he was nephew to von Hindenburg and second cousin to the devil. Fitzgerald preserved a small cutting in his scrapbook, a newspaper photograph of himself, Zelda, and Scotty. Later, another cutting of the same photo was found on which a note had been scrawled. En route from the coast. Here for a few days on business. How are you and the family, old sport? 7/20/23. Gerlach. There is little reason to believe that Max Gerlach's noble predicate, Vaughn, was any more authentic than his use of the aristocratic affectation, old sport. But his improvement of his name may be mimicked in James Gatz's transformation into J. Gatsby. Max Gerlach has haunted Fitzgerald scholars for decades, and some years ago a few hired a private detective to run him to ground. A man named Max Gerlach ran a garage in Flushing in the 1930s and attempted suicide by shooting himself in the 1950s. When Gerlach joined the U.S. Army in 1917, he was required to give character references. Two of his references were Judge Ariel Levy and George Young Bochel. Levy was known as a fixer for a gangster named Arnold Rothstein, and Bochel was an attorney and the frontman for a floating gambling club run by Rothstein called the Partridge Club.
We've just heard Careless People by Sarah Churchway.
Readers, I think you'll agree these women excel at storytelling, at creating wonderfully rich narrative tapestries and charting their characters' internal as well as external journeys. To see what other bestsellers are truly worth your consideration, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope to have you back with me in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.